Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Sleater, Judge Conley, Judge Larkin, the Honorable Randall J. Sleater now presiding.
Good morning, may be seated.
Welcome to the Court of Appeals. What day is today? March 22, the first week of spring. It may not look like it from outside, but indeed that's what I've been told. We have three matters on our oral calendar, one on our non-oral calendar today. For counsel that's here, by the way, you notice you have basically three options of podiums. The middle one is still your best option because it has the little button in front of it to rise and lower to your liking. It also has the clock on it, so you have a better idea of your time. We do ask that when you approach the podium that you do identify yourself for the record. I'll note for the record, A220956 is our first matter. City of Waite Park is the respondent, Ton Weers, relator, and PERA. I don't believe they filed a brief and will not be appearing today. So if parties are ready, counsel for appellant, you may approach and begin. Marshall, if I could have you switch the time to 15 minutes, if you're able. There you go. Thank you. You may begin, counsel.
May it please the court. My name is Attorney Mary Beth Boyce, and I'm here on behalf of Relator Todd Weers in this matter. This case is about a healthcare continuation appeal under 298A.465. PARA found that Mr. Weers incurred a duty disability within the meaning of 35301, subdivision 41. And then the City of Waite Park had contested his ability to receive the health care continuation benefits. And then in the proceeding at the Office of Administrative Hearings, they had to show that that PARA was more likely wrong than right when they found that he met this criteria. Your Honor, do you mean the burden of proof issue?
Yeah, but in terms of the burden of proof, what did the city have to prove? And it looks like both sides are saying what the city had to prove is that PARA was, what the city had to prove, PARA was more likely wrong than not.
Yes.
Does that recitation of what the city had to prove come from case law, statute, or where do you get that?
I'm trying to think if I'm... No.
But in some of this court's unpublished cases, including a recent one, we have said that what the city needs to prove is that Mr. Weers did not have a duty disability. And it seems to me that's a little bit different than having to prove PARA was more likely wrong than not. I mean, it's sort of similar, but it's different.
Yes, Your Honor, and I believe you're referring to the December 2022, the City of Minneapolis versus TSIC, which was an unpublished decision. That would come from the fact that the statute lays out those four criteria, and we've, on the record...
The four criteria for duty disability?
Yes, for duty disability.
Let me ask you this one, I'll ask the city to pay attention, because I'd like the city to address this as well. It seems to me that if the city proves PARA was more likely wrong than not, it doesn't necessarily mean that the city has proved Mr. Weers does not have a disability. What's the phrase?
Duty disability.
Duty disability. So you see what I'm getting at? It's one thing to say, well, PARA's decision was wrong. Does that necessarily mean the city has proved that he does not have a duty disability?
Yes, because it has to shift. We had to make an affirmative showing to PARA.
And you did.
Yes. And then, and I also want to parse out, too, you're not talking about procedural requirements, because there's some
No, I'm just wondering what it is. It seems that everybody agrees that the city had the and everybody agrees that since Para found he has a duty disability, the city has to prove he didn't. That, to me, seems different than the city simply having to prove that Para was wrong.
Yes, I think I'm struggling conceptually with this, with that question. And I would say that it goes to the that this is the way that the courts have always looked at it, those the four statutory elements in.
I agree.
Yes.
I'm not suggesting we should look at it differently. I'm just wondering what exactly the city has to prove. Mm. Because the city in a case could come in and say, boy, Pierre's decision can't be sustained because look at everything that's wrong with it. Does the city have to go one step further and say, and here's evidence showing that he actually does not have a duty disability?
Yes, Your Honor, because
that's what I'm getting.
Yes, because they have to make the affirmative showing during that proceeding. So they would have to show that it was something else, or it was a non-work related issue, and for example, that caused PTSD, or that Pear relied on experts that did completely the wrong thing.
That's what I'm getting at. Is it enough for the city to simply say, well, here's what's wrong with Pear's decision, it can't stand, or does the city have the burden to go one step further and say, and here's the evidence, whether they presented or it's already in the record, that shows he does not, in fact, have a duty disability? Because at the end of the day, it seems that what we all want to know is, does he have a duty disability or not? And that may or may not be the case.
Yes, and I
simply rejecting Pear's determination.
And even though it's an unpublished decision, I think the City of Minneapolis versus Tisich shows that a struggle that the Office of Administrative Hearings had, that the judge in that case acknowledged that it's an uphill battle to prove that somebody has to make an affirmative showing they do not have the duty disability. And in this case, the record...
Well, I mean, who cares? If the statute says that, then the legislature's made the call that, you know, we're going to lean a little bit in favor of the employees for all the reasons we want to do that. And now if the city's saying no, well, then the city's got to prove not. So, following up on Judge Larkin's excellent question, so it's your position that the city has the burden of proof to prove under the statute that your client did not have a duty disability, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And you're saying, among other things, I mean, clearly you hated this decision.
I did.
The ALJ shifted the burden of proof.
Yes.
Okay. I had a question, and you also said you hated, I don't know if I pronounce his name right, Dr. Gulrajani's opinion. Para, explain to us how it works. So you apply for your benefits under Para, and then Para has the right to order you to do an IME.
Yes, they do.
And if you don't, there's some consequences to that.
No, Your Honor, not necessarily. That's the procedural. There's a part of the statute that actually hasn't been decided yet. That there's some in the statute. There's procedural outlines for how Para has to look at or how Para has to do the application process.
Well, I'm looking at 353.031 subdivision 7. Refusal of examination of medical evidence. If the person applying to receive a disability benefit refuses to submit to a medical examination or fails to provide or authorize the release of medical examination, the association will cease the application process or shall continue the payment of a disability benefit. So clearly it seems like your client's got to do that.
Yes, I wouldn't disagree that.
So what I want to know is, okay, and God, there's a million doctors. And then the city hires Dr. Gulrajani, hope I got that right. Do they have the right to ask your client to do another? Does the city have the right to say, well, we want our own IME by our own people?
Yes, they do, Your Honor. And
they did not in this case.
They did.
They
did, and it was not Dr. Gulrajani. He went and submitted for an exam, and there was no published report from that exam.
So is that Dr. Arbisi?
No, that was Dr. Jennifer Service. So she...
So this doctor did an IME.
Yes.
And didn't give a report.
Yes.
Well, that's fishy.
Yes. Yeah. I think.
I would just say it's interesting.
Yes, Your Honor. I think among, that's one of the reasons, I mean.
The city, but it's clear, see, what I couldn't understand is, because, you know, he does his report, Galgiani does his report criticizing their report, which I think is fair game.
Yes.
The question is, can he go one step beyond that, and in his report, which I've got in front of me somewhere, you know, takes that extra step and says, oh, by the way, not only did their report stink, but it's my opinion that the objective, that my opinion that Mr. Weir's purported diagnosis of PTSD or any other diagnosis would not likely to prevent him from performing the specific task, blah, blah, blah. So that goes beyond just attacking. And I have some questions about whether you can do that without actually examining someone. Now, let me just put it to you. Why wouldn't that just go to the weight whether rather than the admissibility? The fact that he's performing, giving his own opinion as to PTSD without examining your client, why is that just, that just goes to the weight, not whether, well, this is out the window, you can't have this.
Your Honor, it would not pass the foundation threshold requirement.
Under Rule 70, whatever.
Yes, that.
Do the rules of evidence apply at a contested hearing?
No, Your Honor, they don't.
They don't.
Yes, they don't. I think they're instructive.
Administrative law judge's own findings say, well, he wasn't disclosing a lot of stuff because there's a culture that frowns on disclosing problems, so it's understandable. So, I mean, it's sort of like, it's how you weight that opinion.
And I think that goes back to your point with the affirmative burden
right.
to show something.
I mean, it's clear that the, and I agree with you, counsel, and Judge Larkin, I mean, the problem I have, and I'm sure it will be explained to me by counsel for the city, was it's one thing to misapply the burden of proof. But while you're doing that, you're also relying on a report, and she really was relying on Galgiani to say he, you know, doesn't have it without even examining him. I mean, I don't know how much weight you can give that. I mean, if that's tipping it, that seems to be problematic to me, because it's kind of like, man, I don't want somebody telling me I do or don't have cancer without examining.
Yes, sir. I think, and that was one of many red flags I would look at this opinion.
Could I ask them, how does RBC's report fit into this? Because it looks like, just so we understand,
sure.
It looks like he submitted to an examination by Dr. RBC at the request of the city. So that was the city's person.
Yes.
And Dr. RBC said he doesn't have PTSD.
Yes.
And the city doesn't call Dr. RBC at the hearing. The city says, well, we don't need to disclose that report. We're just using that report as a basis for Dr. Gulanjani's report.
That's, Your Honor, that's because that was from the work comp proceeding. So I think this goes back to the whole issue that this shouldn't have even happened because of collateral estoppel.
Let's focus on what did happen, just
sure.
In the interest of time. Okay,
yes.
So that was from workers' comp. Why couldn't the city call that doctor at the hearing before the administrative law judge?
They absolutely could have. They could have, and they just didn't. They didn't call him, and his report was also found less persuasive by Judge Bauman in that workers' comp proceeding.
And I've got to ask this question because it's sort of the elephant in the room. This court has a published decision, Conaway versus St. Louis County, apparently no one knows about, which says,
I didn't offer it for not a party either.
Because of determination by PARA, pursuant to 353.656 sub 1, that a peace officer is disabled, is binding on a county as an employer for purposes of determining whether the officer qualifies for continued health insurance coverage under section 299A465, the county is not entitled to conduct discovery on the disability issue after PARA has reached its determination. And in this case, the discovery that the county wanted was an IME after the PARA decision. So, you know, regardless, so the question is, can the city get an IME after the PARA decision? Not really an issue here because it looks like the county did so here. But I'm just wondering, in the bigger picture, I mean, we've got a case that says
They wouldn't be, they can't litigate it. Under the statute, they can't litigate the Paris age. They would have to take it up with the legislature and to rectify that decision.
So you don't understand the way the statute works is we've got a statute that says Paris makes a decision. We've got a case that says that decision is binding and the city can't then get an IME. And yet the city has to prove that there's no duty disability without the ability to get an IME. Now, it sounds like your client agreed to it, so that's fine. We don't really have the issue here. I'm just trying to make sense of this whole scheme because it's very odd.
Yes, that would be a legislative issue, that if they want to fix that under that case law, that they would have to go to the courts and have that allow the cities to then intervene in the original PARA process.
Well, the Supreme Court has to reverse this case, and it's not an issue here because no one's briefed it. I want to make sure everybody is thinking about all things that come into play with this decision. Why don't you go on? I'm sure I have more questions.
Okay. I think so there's the issue of the burden of proof, and then I don't want to get into the arbitrary and capriciousness of the case, because I think my stronger point is the collateral estoppel issue, that this would not apply to every single para work comp case.
The collateral estoppel issue, I don't know if that is your strongest issue, because in the para context, there has to be a determination that he can't work for 12 months because of the disability. There is no time frame in the workers' comp context, so I don't know that the issue is the same, right?
I see my time has expired. May I briefly answer your question?
You may answer yes, certainly.
That's the difference between, it's not the overall issue, it's the factual determination. So because the factual determination in this particular work comp case was, are you off of work from the date of, are you disabled from being a police officer from the date of injury onward? And that determination was over, I think, a three-year period. That finding is then binding on this new.
This gets you beyond the 12 months.
Yes, Your Honor.
So what you're saying is it doesn't matter that the 12-month determination was not required in the workers' comp case. The fact remains that it was made, so it should be binding on the city in the
Your Honor, I'll add a caveat to that, because in the case law states in order for it to be identical issues, it has to be necessary and essential to the findings in the workers' compensation proceeding.
Well, how was it necessary and essential? How was the 12-month determination necessary and essential in the workers' comp determination if it wasn't a required determination?
It was in that particular case, Your Honor, because we asked for wage loss benefits. And in order to get those wage loss benefits, a temporary total, temporary partial, she had to find that it was necessary and essential to award those benefits that he was off for that time period.
Okay, so it was necessary and essential on the wage loss.
Yes, it was.
And the city participated in the workers' comp proceeding?
Oh, yes, Your Honor. They were there. They had counsel. They had Dr. RBC.
And the workers' comp court was not persuaded by Dr. RBC before.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Very well, you'll have 5 minutes, of course, in rebuttal, so you can turn to see the counsel for responding.
We'll probably use all of that time.
Can I just ask that you check your mic?
Oh, Lord, thank you.
Do we want the light off or on?
That's right. I flipped mine off as well earlier.
Okay, is this better now?
The light's supposed to be off.
Okay.
Oh, Lord.
Oh, it says that right here.
Well, screwed that up.
Council must have heard us, though, I think, at least. The recording may not.
Well, this will all stop when we do live streaming, because someone will tell us immediately.
Marshall, do you have the 15 minutes reset? Thank you. There we go. Very good. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Christina Petsoulis, and I represent the respondent, City of Waite Park. May it please the court. I know you guys are eager to get into some questions, but I'll just lay out kind of a roadmap of our main arguments here. So obviously, we believe the court should deny this appeal. Three main reasons there. The appellant really fails to meet that substantial burden to show that the ALJ's decision was arbitrary and capricious and not supported by evidence. Second, I believe the appellant's burden of proof argument is misleading. and also fails to show that the ALJ incorrectly applied.
Do you agree you have the burden of proof? Do you agree at the hearing below you had the burden of proof?
Yes, yes. And it was a preponderance of the evidence standard.
I'm fine with that.
Yep. It,
you know, in looking at the ALJ's opinion, it seems like she didn't say you did. And she, it seemed like she was applying the burden of proof to show that Ms. Boyce's client did. Now, if I'm right, and, you know, I rarely am, isn't that flat-out grounds to reverse, to send it back so that she can do this again, applying the correct burden of proof on you, which may mean looking at Dr.
Gulrajani.
Gulrajani's report and giving it less weight since Dr. Gulrajani didn't interview the officer.
So
now, now there you go. You tell me now why I am wrong.
So if we go to page 12 of the ALJ's decision, we see that, and this was part of Judge Larkin's question before, we apply the burden of proof on the party proposing the action to be made with a preponderance of the evidence.
And that's clearly the law. But throughout this memo, the administrative law judge says that Weirs has the burden to establish that his condition is not work-related. There's tons of examples. Weirs has not made an affirmative showing sufficient to support a finding of his condition's expected duration. Absent a probative evaluation of other evidence in the record that rules out other possible symptoms that could be mistaken for PTSD, the record does not support the necessary finding. I mean, this whole memo says the ALJ expected Weirs to prove with affirmative evidence that he has a duty disability. And I think we all agree he didn't have to prove that. Para found that he did. He goes into the hearing with that finding. He technically doesn't have to prove anything. It's up to the city to prove he doesn't have a duty disability. So how do we look at this memo and say the ALJ did not err in a way that is substantial and warrants reversal?
So I guess looking at those specific quotes, if we read them in full context, I think it's clear, especially with that, I think it was the first quote that you went through. I think it's on page 15. Weirs has the burden to establish that his condition is not just work-related, but the direct result. So she actually cites to the burden of, she cites to the definition of duty disability there. So I believe that that's compelling. I think if she would have put the burden on Mr. Weirs there, she likely would have cited to the burden of proof standard.
But on 15, I'm reading it right here, Weirs has not met his burden to establish that his condition can be expected to persist for 1 year. That's the exact opposite of what she has to do. She has to say that the city has met its burden to prove that, you know, the condition cannot be expected to last more than 1 year. I mean, that's just, look, this is all very complicated. That seems flat out wrong, and for that reason alone, this goes back.
So, I guess I'll just nuance this. So I think the way that she set it up is she said, this is what the standard that we need to apply is, the duty disability standard, right? So it has two prongs. It has the...
So now you're looking on page 12, conclusions of law 5. Is that what I'm looking at?
Yes.
Okay, fair enough.
So when she's laying out kind of that analysis, I believe what she is doing here is saying that in the record, Mr. Weirs has to, he doesn't have to show, but under the duty disability statute, it is required that he has to have a condition that lasts greater than 12 months, and then secondly, a condition that was a direct result of an inherently dangerous duty. So I think if we dissect those quotes, we see that really the ALJ is just saying the record does not show that Para relied on the fact that he had a condition that lasted greater than 12 months, and then second, the inherently dangerous duty prong as well.
Let me ask this. I mean, why do we have to dissect it? In the Tisch's opinion, we wrote, citing to the definition of duty disability in the statute, the ALJ concluded that the city failed to establish by preponderance of the evidence that Titius did not incur a duty disability within the meaning of that provision. I mean, it's very simple. That's what the ALJ is supposed to do. Did the city prove this or not? Now, we have this case where the ALJ makes all kinds of comments about what Weirs failed to prove and that it was his duty and that it was his burden. Why would we dissect that to justify that decision when it is so inconsistent with the notion of the city having the burden of proof and, you know, other case law where that's how we the ALJ is describing what's going on? Did the city prove this or not? I mean, this decision we have here seems completely at odds with what everybody else is doing.
So I guess I would direct the court to focus on, you know, going back to really what is laid out in the conclusions of law, where I think it clearly states that, the party proposing the action in this case is the city.
Right. And I agree.
Yeah.
The ULJ correctly stated the burden of proof.
Sure.
The issue is, did the ULJ correctly apply the burden of proof?
Mm-hmm.
And everything in this memo says that the ULJ did not correctly apply it.
So I think
which
my...
Which then, you know, ties into this notion of, okay, that the expert on whom you rely or the city relies didn't examine him, did a paper review. If the city has the burden to prove no duty disability and they're relying on an expert who did not do an evaluation and rejecting the opinions of several experts who did do an evaluation, does this start to look arbitrary and capricious?
No, and the reason for that is
it does to me.
It does to me, yeah.
So with respect, I just want to kind of go back to Dr. Gulrajani's opinion here, and I do want to note that part of his expertise is as a forensic psychiatrist, which is reviewing what is in the record. So what the city hired him to do was really dissect and go through what was in the record to see whether that substantiated a duty disability finding.
And that brings me back to my first question. Okay, mm-hmm. Let's say we accept it was fine for Dr. Gulrajani. I keep thinking Giuliani. Gulrajani, I'm sorry. It was fine for him to give an opinion based on a document review. That happens all the time. I'm okay with that.
Mm-hmm.
So if he gives an opinion that says, all these opinions are no good, here's why they didn't do it correctly, then the next question is, okay, if all that's out, what is the city offering then as a basis for the ALJ to conclude he does not have a duty disability? Because it's one thing to say, all these opinions saying he does have a duty disability were wrong. Okay, fine. What evidence shows that he does not? Because even if those other opinions were wrong, it does not necessarily mean that he doesn't have a duty disability. It seems like we need some sort of evaluation that tells us he does or doesn't have a duty disability.
In order to meet your burden of proof.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do you have that?
Yes, we do have the burden of proof.
Who says that?
Gulrajani
or opinion 7. It is my opinion that Mr. Weir's purported diagnosis of PTSD or any other diagnosis would not likely prevent him from performing the specific tasks, blah, 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 for the, 12 months. So is that what you're relying on to say you met your burden?
Yes, but also, I mean, I think it's overwhelming to look at the record and see that that is the conclusion.
I may disagree from my cherished colleagues. I think it's one thing for a forensic psychologist to do a paper review and say they got it wrong because, they had to find 5 things and they didn't, there's 4 out of the 5. That's different from, okay, not only did they get it wrong, but now let me tell you what he does or does not have myself. And there, I think it gets tricky whether you can do that without examining the patient. I mean, not the least of which is, we've taken a look at some of the ethical issues. Ethical principles of psychologists and code of conduct, 0.702 forensic assessments. number C, you know, they basically suggest you're supposed to do a personal interview when despite reasonable efforts such as examination is not feasible, and I assume you're suggesting that examination was feasible because apparently you did an IME, and then, you know, I'm just reading between the lines, didn't like the results and said pass. Psychologists clarified the impact of their limited information on the reliability and validity of their reports and testimony, and they appropriately limit the nature and extent of their conclusions or recommendations. I think that says hammer them, hammer the other guys, but I don't know that seems to suggest it's unethical to say without interviewing the patient, oh, by the way, he does or does not have PTSD or schizophrenia or, you know, all the rest of it.
Yeah, and I mean, maybe that expert can say, well, based on what I'm seeing, it's very unlikely that he has that. But, I mean, and I'm not sure, and I don't want to get into the ethical issues, whether the psychologist or a psychiatrist can or can't proffer a diagnosis without an evaluation, but it's like, how much weight do you give it? And I mean, it just doesn't seem like that's enough weight to carry the burden in the face of all these other opinions. And we're not going to reweigh, but we certainly can say it's a danger signal that tells us the ALJ didn't take a hard look at this.
Well, I think, you know, I have two responses to that. I think, one, it's important to note that, you know, it was the ALJ's job to really look at kind of weighing the evidence. And I will note that, you know, Mr. Weers did not have an expert testify at the hearing, and I think that...
But he didn't have to. He didn't have a burden. That's the thing. If he doesn't have the burden to prove anything, he doesn't have to present any evidence, like a defendant in a criminal case. Mm-hmm. Prove I don't have a duty disability. I'm not going to present any evidence. I'm not going to testify. I'm not going to offer anything. That seems to be how this is set up.
Your Honor, I think it's important, well, also to talk about what that standard of proof, though, is. And so it's a preponderance of the evidence. So really...
51%. Or 50, no, 50.0001%.
Right. So when the judge was weighing the evidence in the record, you know, she came to that, you know, reasonable conclusion that based on what's in there, you know, Gulrajani's report is more comprehensive than all of the other ones. And part of his opinion really looked at that the other reports from Mr. Weers were not comprehensive in the way that they needed to be in order to reach a PTSD diagnosis.
I think you should take some time to respond to the collateral estoppel argument, which okay. I now understand a little better. I mean, Mr. Weers' attorney has explained to us why the determination regarding the length of disability or projected length was a necessary finding in the workers' comp proceeding. So why wouldn't we say, well, that issue was a necessary finding, the city was there, the city opposed it, it is now the finding that's binding?
Because you didn't appeal.
Sure.
Yeah, because you didn't appeal.
There's a few things. I mean, first, I'll note again, I mean, the duty disability definition has two prongs. It's not only the duration prong.
I agree, but okay. What the city seems to be saying, it's like, nonetheless, in the workers' comp claim, we had to prove that this would be a long-term disability, and the workers' comp court found it was a long-term disability over the vigorous objection of the city. Therefore, that factual determination should be binding on the city here.
Well, and I'll note that I think in the ALJ's decision, I don't think that the 12 months duration part of it actually was as compelling to her as the direct result of inherently dangerous duty prong. So I think she found in the order that...
Okay, so what you're saying there is, okay, even if that duration finding was binding on the ALJ, she still would have rejected it because the
correct
causal connection wasn't there.
Correct. And, well, in a very specific causal connection, I think it's important to note that in workers' comp, there is a PTSD presumption, meaning if you're a police officer or a firefighter and you are diagnosed with PTSD, it's presumed that it's work-related. So that does not exist in the duty disability case. What we have in the duty disability case is a necessary showing of inherently dangerous and a direct result. Not just a result, but a direct result. So there cannot be any intervening factors. So that's why there needed to be those additional fact-finding in the duty disability case. All right, looks like I'm out of town, time.
If you want, if there was a sum you wanted to do, feel free to do it if there's any additional, and then.
I think I covered it, so thank you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Tough questions today.
Yeah.
Counsel for appellant. You may proceed.
Okay, please, the court. Just to briefly respond to that presumption issue in the workers' comp proceeding, that was a 2019 change to the law. This was a 2018 date of injury, so there was no presumption that he incurred PTSD in the Office of Administrative Proceeding. So in that, the workers' comp proceeding, we had the burden of proof to show that he had an injury as defined in the Minnesota Work Comp Act.
Okay, so you're saying in workers' comp, you had to prove the causal connection.
Yes, Your Honor.
And the time duration.
Yes, Your Honor.
So those findings should be binding in this different context, because even though the issue is different, the factual findings are required in either context.
Yes, Your Honor. And that is supported by the school board case and
Well, what do we do with the fact that application of collateral estoppel or res judicata, they're discretionary doctrines. So why would we say the ALJ, assuming it is the same factual determination, the ULJ had authority to say these findings are binding, why do we say the ALJ abused her discretion in not applying collateral estoppel here?
Your Honor, I believe that would be, since that's a matter of law, it should be a de novo review.
So I thought application of collateral estoppel is discretionary, so we would review it for an abuse of discretion. And I could be wrong, but that's my understanding. I always think of it as something you can do, you don't have to do it.
I believe, Your Honor, that that's that this court should look at it as a de novo under Graham, and she had to find that this applied if those factual findings were necessary, essential to the prior proceeding. Because then we have what exactly happened in this case. You have two judges out of the same judicial body finding two completely different decisions out of the same set of facts. But even if it was discretionary, I guess, if I take that back, then I would say that goes, again, to this arbitrary and capricious nature of the decision in that context. Here's this other ALJ, or here's a workers' comp judge who also found under these same set of facts.
Let's say for the sake of argument, do I pronounce it correctly? Is it Ms. Boyce?
Yes.
Let's say for the sake of argument, we don't buy the collateral estoppel issue, which would get you home free reverse. But we think the ALJ blew the burden of proof, and therefore, and also has to do a deeper dive on the weight of Caljurani's opinion, since he didn't interview your client. What happens then? Do we reverse and remand for a new hearing in which we tell him or her to apply the correct burden of proof? Oh, and by the way, Caljurani didn't interview this person, and apparently we also found out today that there was an IME. It's not that Weirs refused the city's IME in this procedure, they just didn't use it. I mean, I'm certainly going to put that in a footnote. But wouldn't it then be reversed and remanded for a new hearing for the ALJ to correctly apply the burden of proof and correctly give Caljurani's non-interview forensic report the correct weight, whatever that is?
Your Honor, normally, yes, that if it's the wrong burden of proof, you should reverse and remand. But in this case, you would not have to remand because if we're looking at that 51% in that context of Golrani didn't interview him. We have Dr. Service. We don't have a report. We had the ALJ didn't even talk about Dr. Cronin's report, who performed an in-person evaluation, and that wasn't mentioned in the record. So if you look in that context as a matter of law, you can't find that they found that they met the burden of proof.
So you're saying no remand, you're saying reverse because
no fact finder,
yeah,
applying the correct burden of proof,
yeah,
giving due weight to the evidence, could have found that the city met its burden, therefore you win.
It's really arbitrary and capricious.
Right.
It's the whole mix.
Yes.
The burden of proof is wrong. You know, you ignored one person who says he does have it. You gave a lot of deference to somebody who didn't evaluate him, even though the record shows he was willing to be evaluated, was evaluated, and the city didn't bring that evaluation. It's just like all of these things lead a person to say, this decision's wrong, cannot stand.
Yes, Your Honor.
And I bet you'd like us to do that in a published decision.
I would, Your Honor.
What would our syllabus point be? I mean, would we clarify exactly what it is the city needs to prove at one of these hearings? In other words, the city has the burden to prove that the employee does not have a duty disability.
Yeah, I don't think that you have to do that. Maybe that's something that the courts want to address.
Well, I'm just surprised that I see that articulation of what the city must prove in other administrative law judge orders and in other unpublished cases, but here the city's required proof is stated as Pera's decision is more likely wrong than right. That seems different to me, and it seems to lessen the city's burden of proof because it seems to say all the city has to do is prove that Pera was wrong. They don't actually have to go to the next step and show that he doesn't have a duty disability.
And I might just add the fact that ULJ four or five times, you chalk one up to a Scrivener's error or a mistake and then the other, but when you have it so many times, the ULJ herself seemed to have this burden confused.
I think on its face, we can read the decision and know that the ALJ put the burden of proof on my client when they didn't have to. Thank you.
Thank you both for engaging.
We do appreciate that, both counsel. Thank you very much for your briefing and answers to our questions, even if you didn't like some of the questions as they were posed, depending on which side you're on. We appreciate that. We will take the matter.
We did like all the answers, though.
Exactly.
Thank you.